But we would like to welcome you to session number 162 and hope that you have all turned off your cell phones and noisemakers and are ready for a treat, because I think this will be a great session. I'd like to briefly introduce the speakers, and then we'll have them in the order of the program, and then hopefully I have some time to ask some questions after we have had the speakers. So hold your questions for them, but please do think of some questions, because I think we'll have a little bit of time, although we do have to get out of here in a timely manner. Well, let me tell you about our first speaker, Chelsea Wheeler-Whitby, which is a pleasure for me to introduce, because Chelsea is my student at Weber State, and I guess I can claim her. And she wants to, she's probably the only student I've ever had at Weber State who wants to be a Mormon feminist, so I'm just like, I'm a Mormon feminist scholar, so I'm so impressed that I can't tell you. But Chelsea has it's really quite refreshing, and I was just saying that it was quite refreshing in the session before this one to see all those young, hot guys interested in anarchy. I have to tell you, that just got me all heated up. Okay. But Chelsea is a BIS major at the end of the summer, which is an integrated studies degree. Her three areas of integrated studies are women's studies, English, and family studies at Weber State. She plans to go to graduate school in the fall, or at some time next year. She says her interests are in women's issues, and they began when she started her mission and served her mission, an LDS mission, in Estonia. Her research interests are women and religion, feminism and Mormonism, and women in the scriptures. And I think you'll enjoy her paper very much. After we hear from Chelsea, we'll hear from Doe Daugherty, who has been a wonderful Sunstone presenter for many years, and I have enjoyed her presentation so much, and told Chelsea that she would have a treat in being on the same panel with Doe. Doe is currently working on her dissertation for a PhD in religious studies at Arizona State University, where she teaches in American religion. Her main interest is in new and alternative religions in America, such as Mormonism and Wicca, especially issues relating to conversion, legitimacy, transmission of tradition, religious music, and book publishing. So now we'll go straight to Chelsea's paper and then to Doe's. Thank you.
Thank you, Becky. The title of my paper is Unquieting Women's Voices in the General Membership of the LDS Church. I wanted to... Okay. Can everybody hear me in the back? A little louder? I feel like I'm yelling. Okay. Are we good?
Okay, go really loud.
I think that's... Okay, I'll try and yell really, really loud. If you can't hear me, then maybe move a little closer. That might help. All right, I wanted to start by telling a story. Not long ago, in a sacrament meeting that I was present at, there was a missionary couple, a husband and wife, who had served in the area and were presented to speak to the congregation. The wife was first on the program, and she would be followed by her husband. As the woman stood to speak, her body language showed obvious signs of distress and nervousness. As she fidgeted with her hands and she had a difficult time making eye contact. As she began to speak, her voice shook, and she hesitantly said, "I usually leave the speaking up to my husband. Soon the bishop will know why they shouldn't have asked me to do this." What at first appeared to be a simple case of nervousness for being in front of such a large audience quickly appeared to be a severe lack of confidence and belief in her own ability to speak. In her ensuing statements, there were apologies made for her inadequacies and comparisons to others who should be in her place instead. I've seen many variations on this theme throughout my time observing women's behavior in the LDS Church. It seems to me that there's a general lack or a general tendency among women in the LDS Church to feel inadequate, or at least less adequate than some of their peers that are male, when it comes to giving doctrinal opinions or when publicly discussing topics related to their religion. As the subject of this paper, I'll address why I think these inadequacies are so, I'll do this by discussing male and female roles and some of the incorrect inferences that were put upon those roles. Also, I'll talk about how the doctrinal ignorance is a consequence of such incorrect inferences. Then I'll also explain four ways in which women may gain more confidence in their varying roles. First, my male and female roles within the church section. Janice Allred notes that the church teaches that women have different but equal roles. This is supported and justified within the church's doctrinal teachings as stated in the Proclamation to the World on the Family, where it states, "Fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection of their family. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. In these sacred responsibilities, fathers and mothers are obligated to help one another as equal partners," end quote. However, there are certain consequences that naturally come from such a definition of separate male and female responsibilities. These can be detrimental to women's potential to be a well-rounded whole individual if they're not seen in a reasonable light. The quote stated above uses the word primarily, which I'd like to focus on. When defining women's responsibilities, it says, "Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children in these sacred responsibilities." In the statement, both the physical and emotional needs of the children are accounted for. If read literally, the designated role of women as nurturers is a priority, as connoted by the word primarily, but not all-encompassing, leaving no room for expansion in any other area of one's life. But what I believe was meant as a general guideline to ensure the health and well-being for children has turned into an all-encompassing rule, which seemingly bars women from all the other pursuits and interests outside the familial realm. Women's popular conceptions of their roles usually infer boundaries that are not actually set out explicitly in church doctrine. Because of this, women often choose not to engage in activities outside of the primary nurturing roles because they think that it's their religious duty. They do not participate in religious life as fully as they could because they do not think they are supposed to. Personal accountability is greatly emphasized within the LDS religion concerning members' relationship to divinity and his or her salvation. Choice and accountability, in fact, is one of the top seven values that is taught to the young women in the church, emphasizing one's ability to make choices and also accept the consequences of those choices, whether they be good or bad. Along with this emphasis is the teaching that men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgressions, as found in the Articles of Faith. In this lies the motivation for that personal accountability. In order to be able to live by the guidelines set out by the church, an adequate understanding of those guidelines and principles is needed by every member. It is ironic that oftentimes an in-depth understanding of the ideas espoused by the church that dictate salvation are left unemphasized by the general membership when it comes to the female population of the church and their learning, teaching, and being proficient in those doctrines themselves. So what are the reasons for some of these incorrect inferences or incorrect interpretations of the doctrine? Well, there are a number of reasons for these incorrect inferences within the general population of the church. As a child, I remember my mother reading the scriptures to me and making comments, excellent comments, about what they meant. But when it came to voicing those opinions and those comments in a more public sphere or doctrinal discussion, she was silent. When I asked her why she didn't speak up more about the things she thought, her answer to me was that she didn't know as much as the other ladies. Many of them, she explained, had been on missions or served in capacities that she felt required a deeper understanding of the doctrines and the church's teachings, such as Relief Society or Sunday School teacher. She, quote-unquote, had not been on a mission and had only served in the primary. Therefore, she felt that she was not justified or qualified to join into the degree that she might have enjoyed. The number of women that serve full-time missions, in contrast to the amount of men, is much, much lower. Although this is not the only way to gain gospel knowledge and understanding, serving an LDS mission does give people experience in the church's public life and also gives opportunities for one to learn the scriptures in a manner that will allow them to teach those effectively to others. It also increases a woman's credibility when speaking on gospel subjects. Because women are less likely to go on LDS missions, they are much less likely to get that experience. In speaking with a woman who went on an LDS mission early in her 20s, she said, "My mission helped me gain a truer understanding of the gospel, and now I feel a lot of respect from people. They say, 'Oh, she went on a mission. She knows what she's talking about.' Where before, I don't think that I have that type of confidence," end quote. The fact that most women in the church don't have that type of experience in their early lives provides a context in which it is easier for an individual woman to assume that she lacks the knowledge and skills to actively participate in a more public aspect of church life. The same woman as above continued by saying, I was able to, for a year and a half, study the gospel, get training from great leaders, and now I feel like it's solid. Now I'm not afraid to say I know or this is what's taught. I feel like I'm a lot more confident where I probably wasn't as much before. End quote. Because guidelines within the church have always been that generally men's roles are public and women's private, any crossover into the opposite field of responsibility has been seen oftentimes as neglecting one's own primary role. This amounts to, in the eyes of some, a desire to go against the commandments of God concerning the responsibilities of women and men. Systematic research regarding gendered participation in church life is seriously lacking. However, anecdotal evidence suggests that when speaking, teaching, and taking part in the instructional portion of the church is concerned, men tend to take a more prominent role than women in the public sphere. This could have less to do with church policy and more to do with the perceptions of individual members, I surmise. The self-imposed restrictions on religious participation become even more of a problem in light of the church's doctrine on personal salvation. The Book of Mormon contains the instructions to work out your salvation with fear before God. And the church's founder, Joseph Smith, applied this concept specifically to women while organizing the Relief Society, saying that they were responsible for their own salvation, that they had access to every needed blessing the priesthood gives, and also had direct access to the Holy Ghost and to the Savior. He encouraged women to model the Savior, become like him, and become heirs in his kingdom. The guidelines for female roles and responsibilities, such as those found in the Proclamation to the World and the Ensign magazine and other church official church materials, do not specifically spell out, but rather assume the understanding that doctrinal knowledge is part of a woman's nurturing role, and therefore this responsibility is relinquished and left entirely up to the men oftentimes. In contrast, the hierarchical organizations of the church and the roles of priesthood include the requirement of doctrinal familiarity for men in association with their leadership, counseling, and conducting positions in the church. Women's more private roles foster unfamiliarity with the doctrinal teachings of the church and keep them in ignorance of their responsibility to learn the doctrine, which in turn perpetuates the problem of doctrinal ignorance. As noted by one woman when speaking of the general leadership of the church, she said, they encourage us to be intelligent, to go out and to participate in the community, to use our heads. I mean, in no way do they encourage women to just sit at home, let your husband excel, and you just take care of the babies. End quote. But she also noted that intense studying is required to gain that knowledge, and that women are not going to gain it by just going to church and listening to the lessons. It's much harder than that. End quote. Vella Neal Evans, an adjunct professor at the University of Utah over communications and women's studies, gave 4 points in which women, if followed, these points could help women participate more fully in the public sphere of the church and gain more confidence in their participation. The first is authoritative self-definition and expression. Second is increased recognition. Third is a respect for the diversity of women's experience. And fourth, validation of female independence. I'll now discuss these 4 points in a little bit more detail. Authoritative self-definition and expression. I was recently at my local church building when approached by one of the men in the ward. Quite seriously and calmly, he complimented me on my long hair and then quoted the King James Bible, 1 Corinthians 11:15. But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given for a covering. I laughed, thinking that this was a joke, but when he didn't laugh back, I realized that he was serious. Decisively, he confirmed his belief in that scripture and went on to explain that that's why his wife and 2 daughters both have long hair, and they do. It's down to here. He congratulated me on keeping my long hair the way it was and for following scriptures, and he urged me to continue following like this before ending our conversation. I walked away wondering if he really believed that every woman that had ever cut her hair was living in sin, and if his wife and daughters believed that. I also walked away really wanting to go get a haircut right then, just to see what he would do, but I didn't. All of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has clearly stated the principles which members must believe in order to define themselves as such. Members, or much of the application of these principles, is really left to self-interpretation. Book of Mormon scriptures urge Latter-day Saints to liken all scriptures unto themselves, that it might be for their profit and learning. End quote. thus connoting personal action and application that must take place. Command of doctrine and knowledge gives church members, men and women alike, the authority to interpret those parts of church doctrine that have been left up to personal interpretation. Without that knowledge, a person has to rely on someone else to tell him or her how to live their religion. The desire on part of women for this authoritative confirmation of their right to develop and define self is shown in what I like to call the Sherry Dew phenomena. It took place in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Sherry Dew, a member of the General Society presidency, a public motivational speaker for women, and a CEO of Deseret Book now, became a sort of icon and role model for women of the church. She showed a mastery of church doctrine and confidence in developing personal interpretations of those doctrines, and an independence in developing accomplishments outside of the home. She created an image of an independent, developed, whole, and fulfilled woman, fully secure in her womanhood and in her relationship with God and the church. She provided an actual example of how women could be equals with their male counterparts, not only in theory, but also in practice, while still validating many of the traditional female roles and responsibilities. Recently, I was discussing Sherry Dew with one of my friends, and she said of Sherry Dew, "When you say Sherry Dew, you think of someone who knows what she's talking about, someone who knows a lot about the gospel because she took it upon herself to know and study. I think that every member, if they took that Sherry Dew attitude on, woman or man, can have that kind of knowledge. And I think the more knowledge women get in the gospel, the more confident they are. And the more confident they are, the more willing they are to share. It just takes determination, seeking it out, knowing what the gospel is, reading the scriptures, not reading them and saying, okay, that was nice, I feel good, but truly understanding them like she does, because you're so much more confident, and then you're able to contribute so much more to the church. Through a more open religious culture where women's questions and answers may be shared, an understanding of women's own roles would be more easily achieved, thereby empowering women to define self and family as they feel is correct for them and in the sight of God, excluding all other external opinions of womanhood as being just that, opinions. My next point is increased recognition. In a study conducted by Becky Johns and Sherry Josephson concerning the visual images of women in the church's official magazine, Ensign, findings showed that women were underrepresented. These findings do not prove that women are actually viewed as lesser individuals, especially when it comes to religion, but rather it shows that they're simply not focused on as much when it comes to representation in a more public sphere. Either way, whether it's caused by commission or omission, the respect and recognition of the female experience in relation to the male is long overdue. The image of men in the foreground and women in the back seems to be the historical norm among American society. Gail Collins, author of America's Women, explained the change in women's status and position in society that took place in the later colonial periods and has continued until now. She does this by explaining that with industrialism, the shifting of the family's self-sufficiency moved from family-sustaining to a more market-oriented culture, where women lost much of their status and position in the foreground of society. She says the housewife's contribution to the family started to be described in terms of emotional support, not the kind of economic partnership that had previously been extended to women, end quote. Such positioning of status affected not only mainstream society, but Latter-day Saints, who of course were part of that society also. Oftentimes, the primary male participants in the church-wide general conference, the hierarchical leadership, and the church's micro and macro levels, and the largely male missionary force, all creates this pattern of patriarchy that seemingly overwhelms and rules the female population of the church, just as society's previous generations of male and female relationships had done so. The positions of male in the foreground, as well as was suggested by one woman, was inherited just a little bit, she said. Some radical modern feminist theory would suggest tactics such as giving the priesthood to women as a means by which perceptions of the female membership may be changed. By the nature of this suggestion, it would change the core doctrinal beliefs on which the church is founded. I'm suggesting something much less invasive, which is simply to increase women's doctrinal knowledge, thereby increasing the visibility of women within the church. This could then change the perceptions of women in the church while keeping the foundational doctrines of the church intact. There is an answer to increasing women's recognition and participation in the church that does not involve rewriting the core beliefs of Mormonism in such a way that writes women into the church's infrastructure as exact duplicates of their male counterparts. As the proclamation to the world states, fathers and mothers are obligated to help one another as equal partners, not perform each task alone and separate from each other. Each person, male and female, has distinct roles and responsibilities they are given charge over. An insight given by one woman that I talked to on the subject of male and female roles in the church was, I believe that men and women have different roles, and if there weren't different roles, things wouldn't get done. End quote. When gender roles are seen in this light, it makes it more reasonable to become comfortable with the idea for primary roles and responsibilities based on gender. Now the main conflict is not gender-divided roles, but rather fair representation and equal recognition for each other's gender roles as a vital and important part of the church as a whole. One of the largest differences between men and women's roles in the church is the rhetoric used by its membership to describe them. A perfect example of this is found in the church's history of women and their roles in the church. As times have moved forward and changes have been made to the organizational and structural components of the church, some ideas that were beneficial to the recognition of women have been lost. A really good example of this is in the story of Eliza R. Snow. Some of the words that were applied to her oftentimes were poetess, prophetess, priestess, and presidentess. All of these terms were applied with reverent awe, said some of her contemporaries. But such terms have all but vanished among the language used to describe women within the church and their spiritual gifts. Simultaneously, the use of these words and their male counterparts have increased among the male population. In the general membership of the church, boys are given titles of leadership at the age of 12, starting with deacon and continuing through teacher, priest, elder, and high priest. Additionally, the lay priesthood organization encourages every male above the age of 12 to present himself as a worthy member. In contrast, girls start with the term, not title, beehive, move up through My Maid Laurel and Relief Society sister. While girls are also encouraged to be worthy members, there's no real way of measuring this through advancements dependent on worthiness and activity. Given more defined purpose for all stages of the membership of the church, with specific language to classify them, regardless of their gender or age, would provide more motivation to have ownership in the doctrinal and structural organization of the church. When one feels innately responsible for a portion of something that they are taking part in, they are more willing to invest themselves into the membership they have. This would encourage women to be more active participants in connection with the church's programs, purposes, and teachings. Much of feminist talk today encourages androgynous behavior as the norm. But in the LDS Church, gender, as we've discussed before, is an important component of our makeup as individuals and children of divine beings. The proclamation to the world states the following concerning gender. Gender is an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. As such, women and men who would encourage more equality in voice for women within the church would also encourage not similar roles and responsibilities, but rather equal respect for the differences between the existing roles that subsist between men and women in the church. One can't just change many of the gender roles in the church without changing those core doctrines. Therefore, we need to focus on the changing of those gender roles that are not essential components of the doctrine and our perceptions of them. Next is respect for the diversity of women's experience. I recently was looking through the magazine Newsweek when I came across an article of a woman. At the top of the article, there was a picture. She was sitting in an old-fashioned rocking chair with this fuzzy plaid robe on and fuzzy slippers, and she was looking out a window with her child pressed up against her breast, and she was breastfeeding. This was only pages away, actually, from another story of a mother who, after undergoing an abusive relationship, depression, and suffering the consequences of severe poverty, decided to hang herself and her four children in her Texas trailer. I found it very interesting how both of these stories were stories about motherhood, a common role for women, yet the experiences of motherhood for both these women were as far apart as could be. The understanding of the diversity of women's experience is vital in understanding women and their needs. Women should be each seen in terms of themselves, their capacities, and their abilities, and not in terms of their roles. In the case that I mentioned above, seeing these two mothers as simply mothers and having no differences grossly misrepresents the distance between the two. Motherhood in these cases did not unify, but rather distances these women because of their positive versus negative experiences. Within the LDS Church, motherhood is seen as a number one priority. But what of those women who don't have the financial resources to be stay-at-home moms? What of those who have not the temperaments to be good full-time parents, or those who even lack the ability to have children, among many other reasons for not having a large family or not having children at all? The diversity of their experience should not subtract from the worth of their contributions and lives. In the Doctrine and Covenants 18:10, Christ speaks, saying that the worth of souls is great in the sight of God, thus stating that the intrinsic worth lies not in a person, lies in a person's inner being, not in their abilities at present. I think that if we were all to be judged on our present capacities and the perfectness to which we perform them, each of us would fall far short of that mark. As we're reminded of in the story of Adam and Eve, all of us have fallen or become imperfect beings and therefore are in need of Christ's redemption. Through a better understanding of that fallen state in which we're all in, we can better understand and appreciate women's diverse experience and value each woman for the efforts and contributions she has made and will make in the future. Recognizing that those within the church are each striving for the same goals, but our direction, speed, and strength may vary from woman to woman just as it does from man to man. In discussing this right to make authoritative decisions about one's own capacity and roles, one woman explained the controversy her own decisions created among others in the church. This woman chose to go back to school and pursue several graduate degrees. She also worked in her chosen vocation, which was teaching at a university. When I asked what kind of responses she had gotten from general members of the church toward these decisions, she said that a common one was, "Why are you doing this?" or "Why do you need more education?" She also said that they asked her, "Why can't you be happy with what you've got? You should really be at home." She continued, "My newborn child is 22. She doesn't need me to be at home all day. Actually, she needs me to be out earning the wages so that we can live," end quote. But in contrast to the comments this woman received concerning her educational and career choices, it's interesting that it's been observed that she is actually very well-respected and an authoritative voice in her local congregation on doctrinal issues. Her opinion is commonly listened to and respected by the men and women that she associates with. Once a woman is seen as an authoritative source of interpretation for their own life based on the level of abilities which they currently function in, the more they will be seen as someone who is respected and able to define their experience based on their own needs and not on the roles imposed upon them from outside sources. Validation of the female independence is my last point. I want to discuss this in reference to womanhood and its needed voice in the validation of that independence. During the early years of the church, the practice of polygamy was institutionalized and accepted as revelation from God. Despite grievances and questions, many practiced this new order of living. In looking at those people's responses, those of the women were most surprising to me, and yet at the same time they gave insights into the value of female independence. A natural consequence of polygamy was that men were frequently absent from the home and family. Because of this, women ran farms and businesses. They learned to control themselves and develop resources within themselves that they would not have done otherwise. This resulted in a fruitful and rewarding outcome for those women, which was shown in their taking on of the traditional male traits and thereby becoming more self-reliant and self-fulfilled. One woman, Mary Horn, stated, "The practice got her away from being so bound and so united to her husband that she could do nothing without him. She became freer and could do herself individually things she never could have attempted before and work out her individual character as separate from her husband," end quote. The experience of these women in church-sanctioned polygamy showed that women can be independent and even take on many male traditional roles without losing their femininity or being untrue to their religion. Despite the controversy of the means of polygamy by which women of this era achieved this freedom, the end was pleasing in its effects of independence and the validation that came from other members of society concerning this independence. This could very well be applied to today's settings, encouraging the dependence of women on men in a society simply because independence doesn't fit into their traditional and primary gender roles and responsibilities is really inexcusable. And as a church, we must work to alter our views of men and women to best benefit our members. Well, in conclusion, the voice of women, and by extension the representation and respect given to them as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has in many ways improved, and I think it's important to notice that. It's improved from earlier periods in history, but still there's a long way to go. Until women feel the recognition, respect, and validation that comes within an authoritative stamp of approval for them to be more active participants within the public sphere of the church, there will continue to be women that feel that their only contribution to society is through the offspring that they produce. This thereby neglects the other roles and responsibilities that are not gender divided, such as personal accountability and attaining of doctrinal knowledge. Women's general lack of doctrinal knowledge causes them to see themselves as having limitations to their roles. These limitations do not actually exist within the church's teachings and doctrine, but rather exist in the minds of individual members themselves. Elder Neil A. Maxwell, one of the senior authorities of the LDS Church, said, "For too long, the women of the church have been Christians while the men have been the theologians. By allowing, assisting, and encouraging women to be more theologically inclined, we will have a stronger, more capable, and confident group of women within the church to both fight the incorrect perceptions concerning women in the LDS religion and to work within the church's public sphere to assist the church's purpose and organizations." Thank you. Oh yeah, this doesn't work. I forgot. The title for my piece, I'm a little concerned about. I looked at it afterwards and thought, is that what I really titled this? Do I really use the term Holly Mormon? I guess that's what I mean though. That was my way of signaling, the buzzwords that we usually use, faithful Mormons, temple recommend holding Mormon women, women who, my work usually has to do with LDS women on the fringes. And I really kind of wanted to signal that this is a different kind of, subject that I'm looking at here. So the title for this piece derives actually from an experience I had a couple of years ago in a metaphysical bookstore in Mesa, Arizona, Mystic and Beyond Center for Spiritual Awareness and Healing. I hadn't been to the store in several months, and I kind of see it as one of those synchronicities, yeah, it's a long story. The freeway no longer, I didn't have to get off there anymore, so I never used to get off, I didn't get off there anymore because the freeway went on to my exit, but suddenly I had this prompting that I needed to get off the freeway and go into the store and find out what was going on there, and I really literally didn't know why I was doing that, so it was one of those kind of weird experiences. And so on this particular day, I followed this inner prompt, and I pulled off the freeway, and I walked into the most extraordinary conversation between Mimi, the Latina, older woman, probably maybe 10 years older than I am. I'm 52, so I don't know ages, but she was, she's older than I am. I think she's from Mexico. She's got this very thick accent. I'm not going to try to to repeat her accent. But I overheard this conversation that she was having with another customer, the only other customer in the store. And the first thing I heard was, "Mormon women are my best customers." And that really caught my attention because I'm like, what are Mormon women doing in a metaphysical bookstore, with tarot cards and crystals and stuff like that. And this is several years ago. And she kept talking. She said, "They come in here because they don't have power in that church. They don't have power in that church. And they come in here to get it." And so she kept explaining that these women had come, that women come to her specifically in order to learn healing modalities. And she announced very proudly that two of her Reiki masters were LDS women. And she went on to explain to this customer, and I was kind of sneaking along behind them, trying to not look like I was taking notes on their conversation, but I was taking mental notes. And so she went on to explain to this customer that one of her Reiki masters had come in to find out just what his wife was up to. What is it that she does here in this place? And what is this Reiki stuff? She identified him as being in a stake presidency, and the customer said, "Do you mean a bishopric?" And she said, "No, higher than that."
And so she said that he had come in to find out what his wife was up to. She told him, told to him about Reiki, gave him a treatment, read his cards, whatever that meant. I assumed it meant tarot cards. I don't know. But he'd actually come back again another time, and he felt pretty good about what was going on with his wife. He was just kind of checking it out. And so, of course, this is all anecdotal. I never met these, you know, Reiki masters in her store. So it's strictly anecdotal, but my eyes were really opened because, first of all, I thought I was all by myself. I mean, I'm not a Reiki master, but I think I kind of operate in a vacuum, and I do these things and have these practices that I've talked to about at Sunstone before, but I tend to feel like I'm alone. And so to hearing that these people were up to this in my own town really blew me away, and I was very excited. And so I guess what I want to talk about today is, I mean, I don't have any proof about any of what I'm going to say. It's only speculation. I don't have footnotes. This isn't research. I'm just here to tell you some stories. This is the beginning of a project for me. Because like I said, I usually do, in the past have worked mostly with, looking at women who are a little bit more marginal than this. But what I want to argue is that these women who either practice Reiki or go for Reiki healing, or, you know, they practice it, they're hypnotherapists, or they do crystal healing, or they, do rapid eye movement therapy, whatever it happens to be, they could have become snake handlers, right? They could have become faith healers. Like you see on TV, but that is not part of our inherited tradition. Snakes aren't a part of our inherited tradition. And so, like, surveys indicate that 20% of evangelical Christians believe in reincarnation, and that is interesting, but evangelical Christians don't have a mother in heaven, or a deity, another, you know, a heavenly father and a heavenly mother who exist in harmony with and are subject to natural laws, or doctrines of multiple probations and eternal progression toward eventual godhood. So instead of snakes, LDS women draw from this rich, comprehensive Mormon worldview as it intersects with their lived experience to, as Mimi put it, get power. So Chelsea is concentrated on women's roles in the church, in the institutional church, illuminating our Mormon analogy. I think what she, you know, what I got from her is that there's this, she's talking about the Mormon analogy of Muslim women who wear hijab in order, you know, because it's cultural, you know, it's become Islam because it took that prescription from the local culture. Chelsea recognizes that perhaps even most limitations on LDS women's behavior are not doctrinally based and do not always serve us. So I feel like I'm picking up a little bit different and also valuable thread, exploring the ways in which LDS women operate outside of institutional church settings as one expression of the public face of Mormonism. Because even though they're not operating institutionally, they're not going to do their Reiki thing and saying, I am a Mormon woman Reiki master. They're operating, however, as out of the Mormon worldview. And so they are a public face, part of the public face of Mormonism. And I do think also that an emphasis on power is an important tool to get at what's happening here, despite the fact that most LDS women probably wouldn't articulate their goals in quite that way. So in Mormonism, there is a difference between power and authority, though the two terms seem often to be used together or interchangeably. Authority is usually articulated as belonging to the realm of priesthood and maleness. Priesthood authority is the power to act in the name of God and to administrate church business. If surveys are correct and most LDS women accept the church's assertion of separate spheres of influence and ways of acting, then obtaining ecclesiastical authority does not necessarily concern them. Problems arise, however, when critics argue that LDS women have no power. One of my students, a woman a little bit younger than me with a daughter on a mission, argued very vigorously in my class, in my Mormonism class at ASU, that she has lots of power. She told a story about she was the activities committee chairman, and she said, I have thousands of dollars at my disposal. My bishop never does you know, he doesn't micromanage me. He doesn't insist I spend it on this or tell me I can't spend it on that. And she said, I have lots of power. So the fact she was using that as her argument, or a proof for her argument that Mormon women have lots of power. And what she was relating to is power as an ability to control the environment and to make decisions in her sphere of influence. So I suggested to my class that we make a distinction between power and authority, which helped us to tease out the prescribed ways in which Mormon women access power, despite their lack of access to priesthood authority. Still, we only focused on the social-cultural aspects of church activity, such as women accessing power through motherhood. So I said, so how do Mormon women get power? Well, they have lots of children. You know, so I got all these responses, and I'm drawing them on the board. So the members and the non-members in the class all came up with this list where they get, you know, power, cultural power, social power in church through having children, through getting married first, having children, you know, going to the temple, having sons that go on missions. And who do teaching, who become Relief Society president or whatever. And so afterwards, everyone in class seemed to understand that women who chose not to have children, I mean, and that came out very, very easily once they identified how did Mormon women get power, it was very easy for them to say, well, how do they relinquish that power? How do they get into a situation, or how does life put them in a place where they end up never being able to get that kind of power? So depending on the situation, they never marry, for instance, they're likely, unless in a family ward at least, they're likely never to be Relief Society president. Or if they kick against the pricks in some way, they're going to lose some of that cultural and social power in the institutional space. And of course, so they're likely to not be called to manage that big budget on the activities committee. Or they might even have a bishop who's a micromanager and really does tell them what to do. So it's kind of a crapshoot there. You never know who you're going to get. So it is generally accepted that power is the ability to act, influence, or be effective in the world. And so my argument here is this, that LDS women share an historical worldview, I mean, that's comprehensive, that predisposes them to gravitate towards specific practices, which allow them to develop and exercise whatever gifts they may have discovered they have of psychic healing psychic ability or healing power, even while they attend the temple and support the church's patriarchal structures. So they don't have to be kicking against any pricks. They may just be as happy as clams. So here are some of the ways in which I think they're predisposed for this. First, they believe in a universe where matter can neither be created nor destroyed, in which we have always existed as a spirit or as energy, and that all things were created spiritually, in other words, / energetically, before they were created physically. Second, they share an acceptance of that energy as real. So it's not a metaphor for something, it's real. And of their identity as literal children of God, the same species as God. Third, they are taught that their actions have power, that they have eternal consequence. And so what I'm interested in when I continue to talk to these women is, whether or not as the same species of God, they recognize and perhaps gravitate to ways in which they might develop in themselves the same qualities or capacities that men develop when they are ordained and when they exercise the priesthood. So I'm arguing that the public face of Mormonism can be glimpsed through women who are believing and even who hold temple recommends and are also hypnotherapists and, yes, Reiki masters, not because they are acting as Mormons when they do those things, but because they see these spiritual practices as an extension of their intrinsic spiritual identity as children of God and as God's an embryo. So I'm interested in those women who never question their lack of access to ecclesiastical power through priesthood, but who participate in hands-on healing as consumers of energy work or by being in action through healing modalities such as Reiki and hypnotherapy. Women who feel at home both at church and as hypnotherapists or Reiki masters. So for those of you who don't know what Reiki is, I'm not a Reiki master, like I said, and I can't pretend to know the whole history of Reiki. I know that it's a Japanese modality of hands-on healing. It's can be done for oneself or for others. It's It is conveyed through an attunement process. It's like an initiation, and it's about power not residing in a person but flowing through a person to facilitate healing. And since I followed Mimi around her store, I can't tell you the number of women that I have met, even just since getting here last night. People have been coming up to me, and friends that I've known for years. Someone came up to me last night, someone I know very well, and said, "Oh, yeah, everybody I know does Reiki." I'm like, "That's my point." That's it. And so tell me who they are. So I've become aware that there are lots of these women. But whether they practice Reiki or past life regression, there seems to be at least a couple of variables that these women all share that's really interesting to me. They're trying to heal some sort of illness or abuse that is not fully resolved by priesthood blessings. So seemingly intractable disease, addiction, emotional problems, depression, those kinds of things. Having suffered several years of depression, I know that what it's like to have faith and that a priesthood blessing can heal, but then to not experience that healing and to wonder, you know, what I did wrong or whatever. And so these intractable things, the recalcitrant things that just don't seem to be able to be fixed any other way or transformed any other way. This is not to say that they don't benefit from priesthood blessings. Rather, the people I've talked to say that they are deeply comforted by them, but comforting is not quite the same thing as healing, right? It's not the same thing. So one of my new friends is a woman who has a temple recommend who reports having come to see the priesthood as a tool for navigating. She gravitated to energy work through a friend in the mid-1990s originally to find a practitioner who could help her with the arthritis that was developing in her hands, which the friend had told her that could be due to energy blockage. She also, however, had child abuse issues and had suffered from depression and suicidal thoughts, all of which seemed to get better with energy work. Her bishop, however, although he was very supportive and she appreciated it a lot, he was not able to use church funds to pay for energy work. And so he said, "You're going to have to get a real therapist." And so she did that, and she was very appreciative of that. But one of the things she was able to access through energy work, which didn't happen through priesthood blessings or through regular, you know, traditional therapy, psychotherapy, well, she recovered a memory as a two-year-old of her unborn daughter coming to her as a comforting spirit during times of her own abuse. I cannot pretend to know what she thought. I haven't asked these questions yet. I mean, I don't know what kinds of thought process she went through when she was recovering this memory, or since then as she's thought about it and processed it. But as a hypnotherapist, she is a hypnotherapist, and she does do Egyptian Reiki. She sees her practices congruent with priesthood power and in complete harmony with church teachings. And she interprets experiences like this through a common Mormon paradigm of preexistence and deceased spirit contact. She is not alone in her experience of going to the church first for therapy and then moving beyond it to discover hands-on modalities that she could practice herself. Virtually all the women I have talked to share the experience of recognizing the limits of the church's capacity to help them. And another woman that I've known for almost 2 years reported to me that she went into energy work to help her daughters who had been abused by their father, her husband. And this is, several decades ago. But she appreciated the help. She went first to the church, she said, but realized that they really couldn't help her, that traditional therapy, whatever was happening, 30 years ago, whatever it was, wasn't going to help her, wasn't going to help them. And it was not going to get at the root of the problem. And so she never, however, really could have predicted where that was going to take her, and now she is one of the most respected rapid eye therapists in the Phoenix area, probably the most respected. I mean, everyone knows Glenda's name. I call her Glenda the Good Witch. And she's still very, very active in the church and has added in addition to rapid eye therapy, she does all kinds of energy healing. She's studied with some of the most famous energy healers in the world, like Carolyn Meese and people like that. So, It's clear to me, though I'm just starting this work, that women who practice energy work share the very Mormon conviction that the knowledge and capacities they gain are the rewards of tapping into the fullness of the gospel. I have been struck not by how different they all are, but by how similar and how their stories coincide. So I believe that we were interviewed this morning on
Carousel.
And we had this conversation about, what's really happening here. And I would argue that this is not about trying to, I can't get priesthood here, so I'm going to go here. When I talk to these people, it feels to me, the way they express their stories, it's as if it's just a very natural process for them. They have a question, they have a problem that they need solving, and they go out to solve it. And they're led in this direction. And they've expressed to me in different kinds of language, and each one of them has a different way of saying it, but what they seem to be saying is that they take very seriously the idea of knowledge, of gaining knowledge, of being in action. The priesthood is about being in action. Healing is about being in action. And this is a way for them to be in action and to literally transform their world and the people in their world. So I guess what I want to leave you with is that I know I've come here before and stood at a podium like this and said, I really want to hear from people who do this work, women who do this work. And I want to hear from men, too. But I actually got approved my dissertation project to do this particular work. And so I have both cards and then these little cards and then postcards kind of describing my project. I'm looking for people who have a background in Mormonism. You do not have to be an active Mormon to participate. If you believe in reincarnation, if you believe in channeling or, have goddesses as a part of your worldview, astrology, any of these, Reiki, any of these kinds of energy healing, holistic health, please give me a call, divination, any of those things. My phone number, my email address are on these. I really pass them out to all your friends because I really want to know. I mean, I'm one of you, and so I'm really writing about this worldview that has become so important to me. And so thank you so much for coming.
Say thanks to Chelsea and Dole for their papers today and ask you if you have any questions. Come forward to the mic, although I don't know if it makes any difference.
Okay, just talk loud.
About a decade ago, I received two attunement processes like Reiki, except instead of Reiki, it was a Hawaiian one and a Tibetan one. I'm trying to figure out what you're right. And then I realized after a few years of using these processes, and I also wanted to make the disclaimer, I'm sorry, that this is not a criticism of Reiki or any of these practices, but I realized after using these attunements and doing energy work on people using these attunements that I'd received outside of the LDS church after about 10 years, that I had never given myself power or permission to use the first attunement that I'd ever really received, which was the Holy Ghost. And I realized that it was an attunement process. That was the first attunement I'd ever been given at a very young age, and I had really never given myself permission to use it. And so I realized instead of using those, the Reiki-style energy work, that I was going to start using the Holy Ghost. And so I did, and I have been, and so that I'm using the Holy Ghost to do my energy work now. So
I think that's fantastic, and I think what I would argue is that you get to the heart of that, and we talked a little bit about this before we went, into our radio program. I think we don't trust each other. I mean, I trust ourselves. We don't trust because we're looking outside for an authority to tell us. And so we don't trust we don't trust ourselves to use that.
Well, that's the thing. I think I was waiting for permission from the LDS church or something, and then I realized, you need to give yourself permission. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it's like sort of like not socially sanctioned. It's like they give you the attunement, but oh, God forbid you would actually use it if you're a woman and don't have the priesthood, quote unquote.
Very good. Thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, I enjoyed your papers immensely. Congratulations accepting. It makes me a little nervous. In this sense, I've been doing Reiki since the mid-90s, practitioner. And I have received a lot of energy work. And I know a lot of these mollies you're talking about. But I'm not too interested in having the church look at me. I'm not interested in them reading about what you're saying and having them come after me. So I don't really need their permission, but I also don't really want to be looked at by them either. So I don't know exactly. Well, I did give a talk at somebody. I was very ill, had blood clots hit my heart. The Relief Society president watched me, and bishops all came, and I lived. They asked me to talk in sacrament meeting about what sustained me. So I get up and give in our words how I asked the light of Christ to come into my body and how it came through my body. I noticed I was even almost talking like a temple ceremony. Some people afterwards says, very interesting, very interesting. But I don't really know that, because I have now become my own kind of Reiki person, which that I notice, I use the attunement of the Melchizedek priesthood, of the robes of which I wear in the temple, in my Reiki experiences now. And I don't even remember what they said about that Japanese guy. Very good.
This is a symbolic microphone, right?
It really is. I really think it is.
It gives you permission to speak, though.
Yeah, that's right. Talking stick. This is a question for Chelsea. I liked your paper very much because it seemed to me to be exploring a fruitful middle ground between ordination and non-ordination and what those mean. When you said that the gender, when people cross the gender roles, that's viewed negatively as something that that surpasses the bounds of acceptability. I thought it is primarily operational where women are concerned, crossing the boundary into men's world. If men change diapers, it's a media event. Well, that's a little harsh. Because I think marriages are more egalitarian now, and the fathers do feel that they can be involved in the lives of their children more extensively. But I think that, could you address the status differential of that crossing, a boundary crossing?
Yeah, sure.
Sure, you better come up here, just in case.
I'm a little concerned because...
Okay. Do you think it's... I think it's working, yeah. Well, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking why women, or how women can cross over and why it's not acceptable. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
It is not acceptable for women to do it, but it's praised if men cross into the women's.
That is a really excellent question, and I can't say that I have like a definitive answer for that, because it's really an anomaly to me too. Why a woman can't, you know, if a woman goes and says, well, I want to get an education or a career or perhaps be more, you know, involved in public sphere of the church, then it's this controversial issue. But my first thoughts when you said that were that in the church, the family is emphasized as number one. It's for anyone that knows LDS doctrine, the church is probably one of the most primary, you know, I don't know what's the word I'm trying to think of, just one of the most important doctrines that you can think of. And that role of mother has always been seen as the stability of that family. You know, if the mother is taken out of that, then the family crumbles. And we've heard that for years and years and years, and so much emphasis has been placed on women's position there, which I think women do an incredible job in the home. But removing them, I think, creates fears where, oh no, all of a sudden the foundation of the church, the family, is going to lose its foundational structure, and then the church will fall. And, you know, when they talk about the family being the basic structure of the church. And I think women leaving the home creates more fears than men entering it. Men entering it can only help. It can only increase the family as a foundational point. Women leaving it takes away its stability. Does that make sense? So that's kind of my first thoughts.
Why is that such a fearful
I think we see in society men have a very definite position, and that does threaten that. I would agree with that. Do you have a comment on
women's roles? That's defending men's role. Men defending their roles. Exactly.
I would agree with that.
I just wanted to say the reason I'm here, I've heard about Sunstone for years, and I was raised about Mormon, and now I'm no longer, for one or two, couple of reasons, no doubt. One of the reasons, main reasons I'm here is because I listen to you ladies at work on the NPR.
So weird.
And I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I decided, you're so close, you said, come on down, so yeah. Here I am.
Thank you.
I'm glad I did. I really enjoy the phrase unquieting women's voices. As I understand it, church is wherever loving, thinking ways are chosen. That's church. And if we're going to have a spirit world, and why not? Because it's unlimited thinking and allows for the possibility of phenomenon. Do let's have a logical consistency. It takes a team to get things done on earth as it is in heaven.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you came down. I just wanted to kind of respond to Levina because when we moved from New Jersey to Arizona, my husband became a house husband, and I went to work at a minimum wage, kind of, you know, $7 an hour, working at Borders so we could have health insurance. He left Wall Street and so that we could put our families back together again because of, you know, for a variety of reasons. But he did that for about 4 years, and it had had the most tremendous, it transformed him in so many ways. He actually, you know, David's favorite motto is, you love who you serve. But he'd never ever really served us like that. I mean, service is not just making money. Service is wiping butts, you know, cooking dinner, doing the dishes, taking kids to soccer. He did all that for 4 years. And then I went back to school after two of those years. And so, finally, we needed to make more money than I was making at $7 an hour, and I said, look, you know how to make way more money than me, so, you know, you go do that. Go do your thing. And he did. But during that period of time, one of our children, our youngest child, who's now 18, in Sunday school, they were teaching this lesson, or maybe it was in priesthood, I don't know, in his quorum, but they were teaching the lesson about proper roles for women and men and women. And he said, but my family's not like that. My dad stays home, and he's really good at it. And he says, his report back to me, and this is, of course, I wasn't there, so I don't know, but his report back was that his teacher said, well, they're doing it wrong. And they're going to pay for it. They'll suffer for it.
Personal interpretation of doctrine that should not always be listened to.
Let's give these two presenters another hand. Thank you. Unfortunately, our time is up, but do come up and get a card from Dole if you're interested in talking to her about the issues, and thank you very much for attending today.
Thank you.